I'm Todd Melby, and with me is Amy Sisk, and you're listening to an exploration of housing in Western North Dakota. Here's Amy.
Now, let's get back to the researchers. Todd, I know you had an important question.
So when you guys were studying man camps and man camp-like places in Western North Dakota during the boom, where did you sleep?
We generally stayed at Capitol Lodge between Ray and Tioga there. This is one of the large barrack-style crew camps. It was fantastic for us. It was clean. Everybody had their own bathroom. They provided food. Not much in the way of conversation. Most of the guys, mostly guys. One of the things that I always like to point out is that all of these camps included men, women, and children. Even Capitol Lodge had a special area for families. But generally speaking, they weren't in the mood for talking. They were working long shifts, coming in to get some sleep, and then back to work. In the trailer parks, that had more of a sense of we could stop and talk to people for a little while. One of the questions that I'd ask him during those conversations is about home. Where is home? Is this home? Is home somewhere else? Even people who had lost homes during the mortgage crisis, because this was another dynamic that played into the Bakken boom. It was coming on the heels of the mortgage crisis. So there were people needing to come out and look for work. And the sense of home, which connects to a sense of community, was always in flux for these people as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point you made. That's something I encountered when I was out there in 2012, 2013, 2014. And part of 2015 was that so many people that I met, you know, had just lost everything during the economic collapse of 2008, 2009. They were just really trying to get back on their feet financially.
My name is Robbie Reed. I'm in Killdeer, North Dakota, and I'm from Florida. Came up here for the work. There's not much work in Florida at all. I found a job washing dishes 10 days ago at a truck stop, and I just got laid off because the boss said they had too many people on the payroll. But I'll be 49 soon. I don't know if I want to go into the actual oil industry. I came up here because of the higher wages. Basically, the minimum wage is higher up here. They start you out about 11 or 12, you know, just for a convenience store clerk. Whereas in Florida, you know, you might make $8 or $9, you know, working at a 7-Eleven or something like that. So I'm confident about work, just a place to stay. That's kind of a different story. You got people out here. I was in Williston for a few weeks, and I met one guy. He's making $25 an hour. He's making $25 an hour sleeping in his car because all the oil companies have bought up all the hotel space. And unless you know somebody in Williston to stay with, you're gonna end up sleeping in your car if you got a car.
Yeah, and this is like an interesting element as well, right? So the traditional American dream of community, right, is that you buy your house in the small town and suburbs, whatever, and that you pay your mortgage and you own property and you live there forever and you bond with your neighbors and, you know, your neighbor has your house key, you know, just in case you have to let little Bobby in or something when he comes home, whatever, whatever. And this was all taken from these people, right? With the economic collapse, the housing bubble burst, and so not only, and this is something Brett and I have talked about a lot when we're driving around out there. Not only is this a new form of community being kind of created in these man camps that is being sort of disdained in some ways by local longtime residents of the Bakken, but not only is that happening, but these are people who sometimes just however many years earlier had been living in places like Tioga. I mean, not literally Tioga, but had been living in small towns in Idaho, in the Upper Peninsula, in, you know, Arkansas. These mm-hmm. are people who were living the kind of normative expectation of what domestic life should be in the burbs or a small town. That oftentimes these weren't, you know, lifetime blue collar people, but they had worked white collar jobs, that they had been, you know, they had been somebody, they had owned a house, and now they're being sort of derided or marginalized in certain ways because they can't any longer, because of this fiscal contingency, fit into that fit into that expectation. And I think that was really, really touching to us that you know, in some cases, these guys were still paying mortgages on houses that they just couldn't afford to live in because the economic opportunities weren't there any longer.
And the high cost of housing that they were paying in the Bakken was doing nothing to build wealth for their families. That was money that was just going to often outside investors. A lot of these man camps tended to be owned by people who, many of whom had never even come to North Dakota. Doctors and lawyers would form investment groups to buy into these trailer parks as nothing more than an investment.
Right. So just to follow up on that. So one of the key mechanisms that caused some of the economic problems that caused the burst of that housing bubble in 2008, which is housing not being seen as housing, right? A place where people live, but housing being seen as a commodity, an investment, is the exact same thing that then drives some of the situation, the settlement situation, the short-term settlement, the man camps and things out in the Bakken, right? The story or the reality of entire, you know, apartment buildings in New York that are more or less empty because they're simply parking money there. It's hardly remarkable when you hear these stories that we have as the president, a guy who made his money in development, right? That if the crisis of the 21st century in the U.S. is one that has to do fundamentally with the commodification of housing, the Bakken is a case study for that, and Donald Trump's presidency is possibly part of its result.
Right. So these man camps were not providing a home. They were primarily providing an investment vehicle for people who had never been to North Dakota.
And wouldn't people who disagree with you just say, well, that's the way capitalism works? There was an opportunity and I took advantage of it?
Yes. But for most of the 20th century, individuals, their largest investment would be in their home. This is how you built family wealth from generation to generation, was by owning a home. These workers were paying large amounts of money. So yes, you're right. Some of this is consistent with what capitalism has always been, but it's shifting in the 21st century. A home is not a place for the family to live and to build up wealth over generations. It's become an investment commodity for a wealthier class.
And I just as Bill again, I don't think this is necessarily something that I would even disagree with someone, you know, who's a capitalist. I think that the place where, you know, not to say that I'm not a capitalist. I mean, I'm biggest I'm huge capitalist. I love capitalism. Big capitalist here. But yeah, exactly. But the thing that I got a little troubled by, right, is the interesting thing. The challenging thing, and to me the troubling thing, is the association of a certain set of values with the commodification of housing, right? And so, like, it lurking just below the surface of a lot of our research is the idea that if you're living in workforce housing and you're a dirty guy, I mean, if you're a guy and you're working in the oil patch, chances are you're dirty. And you're working hard, you're working long hours, you're not going home to your family. You're living in workforce housing communally, right? With all these other people, like in a barracks that has all the security around it, that in fact, you're being treated almost as feral, right? And that all we hear out of the, these guys, all these men that they they're predatory, they're hyper aggressive. It's this bonding, this rhetoric of hyper masculinity that surrounds them, right? And then you see these target logistic camps that look very much, you know, somewhere between a prison and a military camp, and you're like, yeah, that's the embodiment, the embodiment in housing of this kind of hyper masculinity. And then the other hand, you have traditional normative domestic life, which is, you know, the nuclear family, and that men are somehow tamed by women, right? This is the rhetoric, right? And that the husband and wife, you know, that the husband may have a man cave, but that's a very like special area of the house where it's off the beaten. You can't go into a man cave unless you're invited or whatever that situation is, right? And so what's bothered me the most is when you see these communities then pushing for increasing housing, permanent housing for people who come out to the Bakken, and they argue that this is for families so that people can live normal lives. They can pay into the tax pool to be sure, but that this is somehow superior to workforce housing. But this is not independent of these housing being built by capitalist developers who, in fact, have a vested economic interest in driving out traditional workforce housing. And so, in other words, the sort of narrative of domesticity, which I think is based on 18th century classism and things like that, you know, racism isn't too far below the surface of a lot of this stuff, the working classes being something that is really different from, you know, the middle classes, is also deeply bound up in the economy of housing, not just in the Bakken, but globally.
Globally.
In other words, the pressure to be domestic now is part of a package that's being sold to us by wealthy developers, and that has less to do with us living the American dream than us investing in some sort of high-powered investment portfolio from a guy who probably has 14 houses and has never been to the Bakken or could place it on a map.
So I think one of our contributions to Bakken research is that, as Bill was saying, we didn't view the workers and their families as feral intruders. Instead, we tried to demonstrate that both the new workers and the longer-term residents were both caught up in this global struggle outside of their control. Instead of seeing them as workers in conflict with the quote-unquote genuine native North Dakotans, we actually saw both groups struggling to try to exercise their limited efforts to either hold on to or to create and engage a sense of home and community amid the chaotic environment of the boom. The decision-making processes impacting their lives were determined less by the local and state policymakers and more by the influences of global capital and outside investors.
In July 2015, I met a guy named Don Williams in Stanley, North Dakota. Don moved to the Bakken to work, but he often came into conflict with locals. His experience was this. Too many native North Dakotans were trying to make too big of a buck off of people like him.
I hope this downplay hurts the greed. Don Williams, I'm not the famous one, I'm the other one. I work for a transload company there in Ross. We supply frac sand for Halliburton. Come up here 3 years ago yesterday from Missouri and probably be here a whole lot longer if they let us. Now, I understand everybody wanting to make a dollar off the old boom. I understand that. But we're all up here just trying to make a buck. I took my pickup over to Minot to have it worked on while I flew home. Their service department gave me a ride to the airport. On the ride, me and the shuttle driver were talking, and he was talking about all the money being made up here, and I mentioned to him about being ripped off. He said, well, we all know you guys are wanting, you know, making $2,000 a week, and we want some of it. I'm not going to repeat on radio what I said to him. I turned my life completely upside down and around. Hadn't seen my wife for 6 months. Moved 1,100 miles on a maybe it's going to work. He's 50 miles from it. Go get it himself. You know, that's what aggravates me about being up here. Is, you know, everybody's got their hand out. They want half of what you make. There's a mobile home for rent. $1,800 a month for a mobile home, and an old mobile home. My wife come up here, we bought the camper trailer, because I am not going to pay $2,500, $3,000 a month for an apartment. So we tried the camper trailer route, and it worked out until it got down to like 50 below. Then we learned that camping in North Dakota does not work in February. When you had to put a pillow up against the side walls, keep your head from freezing on the wall, and the pillow froze to the wall the next morning. That's kind of the way it was. I don't blame people for wanting to make a dollar off of it, but let's get real.
Man, I feel for anyone braving a North Dakota winter in an RV. I remember seeing people wrapping insulation around their campers and wondering how cold it must be inside. It's worth noting that poor living conditions and workforce housing is a topic that's gaining attention globally as a social justice issue. And that's something the UND researchers write about in a forthcoming publication that Brett Weber references when I asked him why that conversation has not seemed to reach the Bakken.
Well, I think in some places there is a more well-established petroculture, and that's just developing here. Bill has been central in creating the digital press at the University of North Dakota, and publishing a lot of this work. The book chapter that we gave you, Amy, will be coming out probably in October. January or February. That's the one that tries to update the 1958 Williston Report. And we've continued to publish on this stuff as an effort to create a regional petriculture. I think there's a stronger sense of that back in Pennsylvania, where you're currently working. Certainly up in Canada, in the tar sands project up there around Calgary, there's a strong sense of petriculture with scholars doing this work. It's just hopefully starting to...
So what's a petriculture?
Bill, what's a petriculture?
I suppose what it means is an awareness that all aspects of society are shaped by our kind of investment in fossil fuels, right? And that petriculture is kind of the study of the relationship between fossil fuels in all forms, right? From the gas you put in your car to drilling and fracking, and larger cultural and larger expressions of culture, whether there's something as everyday as housing or something as fancy as the exhibit at the Plains Art Museum a few years back. These all will kind of get embraced in this kind of notion of petriculture. And it's really a critical engagement with this.
So scholars, a more well-established scholarly community looking at the social and cultural impacts of a petroeconomy, both in terms of environmental but also cultural aspects.
But Amy, I think to get back to your question, I think the real challenge with something like changes in housing is that it's super, super hard. That it's really, really hard how to figure these things out. And that everything from a workforce housing site in the Bakken to a new apartment building in downtown Grand Forks to a camp for refugees in the Aegean or, you know, on the border of Greece and Bulgaria, all these things are a series of myriad compromises where we know that some profound part of our humanity says, and I think you guys both expressed this already, so kind of sharing this, I share your view that housing is a fundamental human right. But on the other hand, yeah, we all got to be capitalists, man. You know, all this stuff costs money. All this stuff involves a kind of a commitment. And taking this idea that housing is a human right and expressing it in an empathetic way, right? And seeing this not only something that we have the right to, but a migrant who's asking for
affordable housing somewhere.
Yeah, affordable housing, or who's asking for sanctuary in your community also deserves this right. You know, to a prisoner in a prison, to a migrant who washes up on the shore of a Greek island. I think it's just really, really hard. In part because it cuts across cultural expectations. It cuts across what we imagine domesticity to be. It cuts across society in lots and lots of really complicated ways. And I think that the more time, even now, that we spend out in the Bakken, the more we see this as a bit of a sandbox that sees a lot of this play out. And part of the reason it makes it more interesting than to just people here in North Dakota is because these are issues that are really on the bleeding edge of human experience right now. That in some ways, I think the Bakken is experiencing the future first, right?
Right. Grand Forks has an affordable housing problem. The whole nation has an affordable housing problem. To go back to the very beginning of this interview, you were asking about how did we come to be interested in this. What we saw was that the Bakken, in many ways, is representative of some of these global dynamics that are contributing to a worldwide affordable housing problem.
So what's the current status of temporary worker housing in Western North Dakota? Are there still man camps out there?
Well, a lot of the big crew camps have closed down and have been hauled away. You can go out and see some of them being dismantled. Our last trip out there, we watched as they were tearing apart some of the large barrack-style housing and moving it away. But an interesting thing to do is go to Watford. Watford City developed a lot of quote-unquote permanent housing. And it looks from the outside like kind of middle-class suburban family-style housing, except as we point out in the book chapter, These are often units with four bedrooms and four bathrooms. This is not built for a family. This is built for some oil workers to live in. So it looks different on the outside, and it has, you know, quaint names given to the subdivision to make it feel like a middle-class suburb. But this is just a new phase in the workforce housing. And it's not clear whether those this new form of housing is going to create a more enduring form of community with all of the democratic aspects of that, people being invested in their community, running for office, taking part, joining churches, etc.
I was going to ask, are these those big kind of apartment complex looking structures that have kind of are on the outskirts of Watford City?
Some of those, but also duplexes. Mostly what you're talking about, Amy. Yep.
And what were some of those quaint names in Watford?
I'm not remembering specifically, but it can be Hawkway or, you know, Watership Downs. It's these kinds of names. I don't have them at my fingertips, but it sounds like something that you might find in some shady wooded glen somewhere. And it's just a new subdivision on the northeast edge of Watford City. Yeah.
Yeah. For me, it was reminiscent of the new housing built west of Williston, which I don't think was for the same purpose. It's intended for people to buy and live there permanently. But some of those streets were named Sleepy Ridge and
right.
Orange Willow.
Yes, yes.
You know, what do you guys think that housing in the Bakken will look like, say, 10 years from now?
We don't know. And one of the reasons that we have engaged in this research and tried to document and publish as much as we can is so that policymakers, investors, 10 years from now can look back. Because when we tried to look back at what had happened with temporary workforce housing in the 1950s and then again in the late 70s and 80s, there wasn't a lot of scholarship about that at those times. We could tell from newspaper reports, et cetera, that housing had always been a critical issue. Housing is critical not just for the workers, it's critical to healthcare, to law enforcement, to education, because you have to have housing to for new teachers, new doctors, new police officers to live in. And when there was insufficient housing, all of the fabric of community was stressed out there. So when we tried to read what were the solutions to housing during those earlier booms, there wasn't good scholarly documentation. We've tried to provide some of that this time around. But we're both historians. It's hard enough to figure out the past. We're not going to start trying to predict the future.
We've talked a lot about housing this hour, but not really the concept of home. So many newcomers I've met in Williston and Watford City talk about home as someplace else, somewhere far away where their loved ones are. That's not to say that none have made North Dakota home, but a lot sound like this man Todd met at a trailer court just outside Watford City.
Y'all ready?
Brian Martindale.
What?
It's almost like high school sports, honestly. Like the crew you work with, it's like you're with them 24/7. Even right now, we're all off. We get together, do something, play basketball at the Veterans Center. We did that basically all winter. We'd go down there and throw the football around. So, I mean, like I say, it almost feels like you're 10 years younger than you are being out here. But honestly, like I say, I can't wait till it's over and go home.
It's been the first 10 yards. I know football.
The hardest thing for me is being away from home. The house itself isn't that big a deal. I can deal with living in the camper and everything, but missing my wife and kids is the biggest thing. Like I say, the money out here is good, which is why I'm here, you know. I mean, kind of on a two-year plan to pay off my house and go back home. I always wanted to be a dad, I guess. I mean, I had good parents growing up. Family means a lot to me, so I always wanted to be a dad. So now that I've got kids, I just love it that much more. One of my biggest reservations about coming out here was the time away from the kids, and I never wanted them to feel like I wasn't there. And you hear stories all the time about kids that feel like they were abandoned by their dad or because he was busy at work and all that, and I didn't want that to happen. So, I mean, whenever the kids know, you know, whatever's going on, even if it's the middle of the day, if they want to call, they can call and talk to me. So, you know, I don't, if it's just that they're happy because they rode their bike today or something, you know, I mean, I want them to call and I want them to know that they can, you know, and I don't want, you know, as close as we are, as me and my kids were before I left, I don't want that to change for when I go back, you know.
How often do you talk to them?
Every day, at least once a day. I mean, at least say goodnight to them every night. You know, if I don't talk to them, if I've got time between runs during the day, you know, and I call my wife and chat with the kids for a couple minutes, you know, just ask them what's going on. I mean, even if I'm out on the road, I'll get a call 8 o'clock, 8:30, you know, just to say goodnight and I love you and all that. So every day, never miss it.
So Todd, 10 years ago, fracking and horizontal drilling were just emerging, and we had no clue how these technologies would transform this region.
Yeah, and it's so hard to predict how it'll change a decade from now.
You know, the Bakken slowed way down a couple years ago when oil prices tanked, but that's not the story today. The price of oil has recovered, and oil production in North Dakota is basically at an all-time high, 1.2 million barrels per day. All that oil pumped out of the ground has helped make the United States the world's biggest oil producer.
Yup. Just this year, America surpassed Russia and Saudi Arabia to claim that top spot.
Of course, anything can happen. It's a boom-bust cycle. But the way things are looking right now, Watford City is going to need those apartment complexes because there's plenty of demand for workers who could use a good night's rest after a long, hard day working in the oil patch.
Black gold, steel toes, big dreams, big goals. Working for the money, working for the honeys, working for the gold, working for the folks back home. Let's go now. Black gold, steel toes, big dreams, big goals. Working for the money, working for the honeys, working for the gold, working for the folks back home. Let's go now. Grab them boots, I'm talking steel toes. Time to get muddy, drilling down to the money. Lose about 5 pounds on a shift real quick. 2 weeks on damn.
That's Amy Sisk. She's an energy reporter. I'm Todd Melby. I'm also a reporter. And I started the project called Black Gold Boom here at Prairie Public. It's still up online if you want to check it out. It's blackgoldboom.com. In the past hour, you've also heard from Brett Weber and Bill Carraher. They're researchers at the University of North Dakota in Grand Forks. And thanks to those guys for joining us and sharing their insights. The music you heard at the beginning of the hour, and also right now, is called Black Gold. It's a song by Chase. Black gold, steel toes. Chase is an artist out of Texas who infuses trap and hip-hop beats into his music. So that's Chase, the name of the song, Black Gold. This program was made possible with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Working for the honeys, working for the gold, working for the folks back home. Let's go now. Trilling so deep, done pissed off the devil. Devil came out, seen the rig, said this is hell. Torque that motor, take that bit straight to shell. Move that rig on over to the next well. Finish drilling, that's a wrap, nah, that's a frack. Tree huggers mad while they're pumping gas. Out here you ain't working unless you beat. Slide that bit in the pay zone, trick or treat. Bit cranking through the ground, got teeth. Hit a big pocket, about to unleash. Make a living out here, turn a new leaf. Ocean coming in fast, take a sneak peek. Got the company man cussing at his feet. Don't mess around, boy, then find a steep. Guarantee you get hurt, gotta have grit. The rig never sleeps, always chomping at the bit. Black gold, steel toes, big dreams, big goals. Working for the money, working for the honeys, working for the gold, working for the folks back home. Let's go now. Black gold, steel toes, big dreams, big goals. Working for the money, working for the honeys, working for the gold, working for the folks back home. Let's go now.